Move on to our next case, Roadway Express. Mr. Posey.
Please, the court. My name is Thomas Posey, and I represent Roadway Express in this matter. As you know, Your Honors, this is our second appearance before the court in this dispute. We were first here in 2006 when Roadway appealed an administrative ruling by the U.S. Department of Labor's Administrative Review Board, holding that the company's termination of one of its drivers, Peter Suflu, constituted retaliation in violation of the Surface Transportation Assistance Act. On July 25th of 2007, this court upheld the Department of Labor's ruling, but also held that an evidentiary sanction that had been imposed during those proceedings, during both the merits phase and the remedy phase of the proceedings, should only have been applied during the merits phase. Accordingly, this court remanded the matter to the Department of Labor with instructions that the sanction should not have been imposed during the remedy phase. In its 2007 ruling, this court held that Roadway should have been allowed an opportunity to show on remand that, quote, it would have terminated Mr. Suflu even in the absence of his protected conduct, close quote. More specifically, what the court held was that on remand, the company should be entitled to show that Mr. Suflu would have been terminated aside from his protected conduct because, first, he had dissembled on his employment application, that dissemblance being his concealment of terminations from two prior companies for serious accidents driving a semi-truck, and second, that he would have been terminated as a result of his driving record.
But see, that you've just, in a sense, rephrased the issue that separates the two of you, because as I read the briefs, it seems to me the question is, I mean, of course, one can always, in hindsight, be more clear, whether it's possible to, on the one hand, continue to enforce the sanction, and on the other hand, open up the remedy. And I think one of the, if you read our opinion as a whole, you can see that the real concern was we didn't want, as a remedy, to force some unsafe driver out on the road. I don't see how, without requiring Roadway to disclose the identity of the confidential source, and without delving into Roadway's entire history of actions based on various misrepresentations and applications, we could use as an independent ground, even on remedy, the dishonesty. Because, as we said in our earlier opinion, for all we know, Roadway found out the day after that Mr. Suflu had done that, and he drove for 4 years, and it's not until the minute after he testifies at the hearing that he's discharged. So I think you fall right back into the trap of your refusal to disclose this confidential source if you don't read our remand order as kind of a comprehensive, would you have discharged him based on this driving record anyway? Now, of course, the dissembling is about the driving record. He didn't dissemble and say, I went to the University of Indiana, not to Kentucky State. I mean, he dissembles about the driving record, so it's important to understand what we're talking about here.
That's true, and in making that distinction, that there's a couple important points. I mean, first, one of the things that we did present evidence with regard to was when that information was in fact learned regarding the dishonesty.
But you never disclosed your confidential source. You didn't give him any way to rebut that. You've been adamant in that point throughout these proceedings. We wouldn't be here if you hadn't been so adamant about that. I don't know whether this is seeming like a wise thing to you in retrospect, but
well, with regard to any bias to Mr. Suflu with that individual's identity not being disclosed, while we will concede that that may have caused some bias for him at the merit stage of the proceeding, it does not in any way in the remedy phase.
Sure it does, because if his statements on the application had nothing to do with the reason that Roadway dismissed him, then he'd be entitled to reinstatement. You couldn't prove that you would have fired him anyway. I mean, you know, that's the question, after all, the Mount Healthy kind of question. Would you, in the absence of this conduct, have taken the same action anyway? And if you can't delve into that dishonesty, you know, you can't show that.
Well, with regard to it, at least the timing of when the information was learned, for example, that information is something that was presented on remand, and that he would not be biased in arguing, for example, that I should be entitled to reinstatement because I don't know when this information was revealed to the company.
But the burden is on you to show that you would have taken the same step anyway. The burden is not on him to go in there and make that showing.
It is, and we would argue that the evidence that was presented through the deposition transcripts at the on remand.
Why the coyness about this informant?
I'm sorry, why the
coyness about the informant?
The company made a decision that the source of the information was not one that it would reveal for a couple reasons, partially for confidentiality purposes, that the information was provided with the understanding that the identity would not be revealed. And while Your Honor pointed out that has obviously led to lengthy litigation, the company stands
an
by
expensive
its
decision.
Decision.
I would say.
It does stand by its decision to do that, and the representation it made to that individual or individuals when that information was provided.
Well, you have to live with your decisions.
The problem. I mean, it makes it impossible, I think, for you to show that you would have, in any event, discharged him. Because if you found out the day after, you know, we don't have to believe what your affidavit said. And if you found out the day after he turned in his employment application that there was, you know, you called up UPS and they said, because he puts UPS as a reference, you easily could have found out if somebody had followed them. And he said, oh, you know, we discharged him because he had this, you know, road accident. And you thought, oh, well, you know, he's had a clean record since then. We'll give him a chance, one free bite or something. Then the discharge still looks like a retaliatory discharge.
And to that end,
on the road safety, which is what the ALJ does focus on, there we have, you know, an actual record created on this remand that suggests that, you know, there are all sorts of people who've done as bad or worse than Mr. Cephalou, who you didn't get rid of.
Well, with regard to the driving record, I would argue that's somewhat unclear, in the sense that because these are all unionized drivers, there's a number of cases where the union has essentially negotiated through the arbitration process with the company settlements of various individuals' discipline.
Well, and I agree with that point, but it does seem to me that you haven't crossed the T's and dotted the I's, because you indicate that you've issued some discharge letters, but that's what you always do in the first step. And then the union might grieve, and it seems entirely possible to me that the union has a policy of not grieving when somebody is accused of dishonesty, but maybe they do grieve if somebody bumped into a trailer in the yard, or if somebody is trying to evade a more serious accident and thus has a problem. I mean, this list of people that the union stewards testify to, where Mr. Deaton with the top of his trailer torn open, or Ms. Sexton, who has 10 or 11 accidents, or the guy with the hazardous waste. I mean, there was a lot of evidence in the record on which the ALJ could have found, or the board, the Administrative Review Board, could have found that Roadway tolerates much worse than Mr. Cephalou's done.
And our concern in that regard is that looking at the record as Mr. Cephalou argued that we should, and to a degree from the ALJ's decision, it essentially says that no matter how dangerous Mr. Cephalou might be, the only concern here is whether or not we can find someone as or more dangerous who's still employed by the company.
Well, not at all. It seems to me if Mr. Cephalou does something dangerous, then you institute the proceedings and you go through the administrative hearings, which you have chosen not to do with his little yard fender benders that he's had.
Well, and at this point, with the issue with Mr. Cefalu's employment is, frankly, he's still employed by the company as a truck driver because the Eastern District of Wisconsin ordered us to put him back to work in that position.
But if he kills somebody in his truck tomorrow, I can't believe the Eastern District of Wisconsin is going to require you to keep him out on the road. I mean, I'm just saying, as the Department of Labor has pointed out in their supplemental authority, you have an independent obligation. I can't believe the company isn't prepared, if cause is shown, to institute on new facts a new proceeding. The new facts aren't there.
With regard to that supplemental authority, one point I'd like to make is that my understanding of the rule is that when new authority comes to the party's attention after the brief has been filed, that it's appropriate to raise that. Certainly the Federal Department of Labor is not arguing that a federal regulation came to its attention later that it was not aware of, especially one that is contained in the same chapter as four other regulations cited in its brief.
No, I mean, Mr. Posey, I couldn't agree with you more that I prefer supplemental authorities that are like that, but I've certainly seen people file these things, you know, citing 1948 cases that didn't just spring into being in the reporters, and the rule, I don't think, precludes that. It's better practice to do what you just described.
Well, to the extent that authority is considered, again, we would argue that in this case, if Mr. Cefalu, for example, had killed someone driving his truck last month, the company would have fired him.
Sure.
The issue here,
your argument that your hands were tied, I really don't think holds up.
I would argue that just to the extent that for a minor incident such as the ones in the parking lot or in the garage, the three incidents since his reinstatement, I believe the company's perspective that, frankly, terminating for him for one of those incidents, while it suggests that he, again, is not a safe driver, is not one that would likely to be upheld and essentially would be viewed presumably as more retaliation for him continuing
well,
this litigation.
That's right, because if you look at all these other people, apparently these little yard accidents, which we don't have a huge amount of data on, are not something that you fire people for. Maybe you reprimand, maybe you put it in the record and build up. I don't know.
And our concern here is this, that at this point, Mr. Cefalu's continued employment seems to be under the terms that in the event that he injures or kills someone while driving, that certainly we can terminate him. But other than that, we have to cross our fingers and wait, and that he's already had three accidents since he was reinstated.
You have to comply. Assume there's a collective bargaining agreement, and you would have to terminate him for whatever counts as good cause, presumably. Is that correct?
It is.
Okay.
It is. So at this point, again, our concern is that if he's allowed to continue his employment, that we're essentially waiting with bated breath, hoping that there's not an accident more severe than the three that have already happened. I see that I've entered my rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Posey.
Thank you.
Mr. Sterman?
Thank you, Your Honors. Given the nature of the questions to Mr. Posey, I really don't have much to add. I think the court understands our brief.
What's your position on this, on public safety? Your brief seemed to suggest that there is no public safety ground on which the company could, or the court could, not the company, on which the court could refuse reinstatement as a remedy.
Our research, well, I don't think that's true, Your Honor, and the point we were trying to make is that
you look at what you say in your brief about reinstatement would not run afoul of these detailed legislative and regulatory regimes. And so the court should reject Roadway's idiosyncratic and self-serving vision of public safety. It sounds to me as if you're saying that a judge can't say, as a matter of, you know, equitable discretion, there has been a violation of law, and the plaintiff is entitled to a remedy, but he's not entitled to reinstatement because that would endanger the other people on the highway.
I think the court needs some standards to look at in making that determination, and that was our point.
I understand that. It seems to me that in any case, when you ask for an equitable remedy, the judge always considers the public interest. And if, you know, if a person is a dangerous driver or he's a worker in a factory and he's endangers other workers, then he doesn't get reinstated.
I think you have to look at the positive law, the regulatory enactments, the legislative enactments, to make a determination as to whether he's dangerous
that.
Or not.
If he's a dangerous driver, he's a dangerous driver. Are you saying that this detailed legislative and regulatory regime somehow says that courts can't make that judgment? That what, only the Department of Transportation can, or what?
Not that the courts can't make that judgment, but I think the courts need to look at these enactments to inform its decision.
Now look, are you arguing that the court can only refuse reinstatement if there's some regulation that says that a driver who has done these things should not be allowed to drive a truck? Is that what you're saying? That the judge has to find a regulation?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. But
what I'm saying
is that the court's determination has to be informed by these.
Now
these
that's mush.
No, I think the court needs.
What do you mean by informed by a regulation?
I think the court needs to look at these regulations to make a comparison.
Right, so he looks at the regulation. What does he find? Should this person, does this, when he looks at these regulations, does he find that Cefalu is a safe driver and should be reinstated? Is that what he finds?
But what he finds is that Roadway didn't establish that he was an unsafe driver, because what these regulations show is that in order for a trucker to be taken off the road, he has to drive much more unsafely.
Okay, so that's all right, but you're contradicting yourself. You're saying the regulations say, it's a little shocking, I must say, when you consider how large these trucks are and how dangerous to other people on the highway, but according to you, what you just said now is that the law requires that the driver be more unsafe before the judge can deny reinstatement. So you're saying the judge is governed by the regulation.
Your Honor, maybe I'm misreading the Eastern Associated Coal case in the Supreme Court, but my understanding of that case was
well, look,
there is.
Don't mention the case. Answer my question. Are you saying the judge would be violating a regulation if he denied reinstatement to Cefalu, because the reinstatements, well, you have this sentence in italics, these laws mete out more lenient punishments for operational transgressions far worse than Cefalu's. So you're saying somehow in the transportation regulations, Department of Transportation has to make a judgment that people who are far more accident prone than Cefalu may not be removed from the road. So a judge absolutely could not deny reinstatement in this case.
That's not my position. And
well, then I'm completely baffled, because I just read your sentence. You say these laws, I mean, it's a clumsy sentence, but the basic meaning of it is that you have to be much worse than Cefalu to be disqualified from driving. Now, can the judge nevertheless, this is a yes or no answer, can the judge nonetheless order Cefalu not to be reinstated? Or can he refuse to order Cefalu reinstated because Cefalu hasn't, you know, qualified for disqualification under this statute?
The answer is that the ALJ can refuse to reinstate.
That's not an answer. I said it was a yes or no question.
Well, I'm
sorry. Nothing to do with an ALJ either. Can the judge deny reinstatement to someone whose transgressions do not compel disqualification under this statute?
Yes.
So let me add something else. Maybe it's a follow-up to what Judge Posner is saying. Suppose, hypothetically, Roadway takes a look at its experience of drivers and its pool of drivers, and Roadway says to itself, we want to be a better company. We really want to establish a higher intra-company standard of safety than these regulations to which Judge Posner is referring. And so we're going to start terminating people who have two accidents, and we don't care if it's in the yard, if it's out in the highway, you know, whatever it is. They establish some higher intra-company standard. That's okay, right? They can try to do better.
Absolutely.
So what does the record here show about Roadway in that respect? And is it really company practice that's at issue here as opposed to the regulations?
Well, there is no clear company practice. It asserts that it has a clean driving record policy, but there isn't any such policy in its rules or in the collective bargaining agreement.
But if it really had a zero tolerance policy, I presume that the minute Mr. Cefalu, you know, bumps into something while he's backing up in the yard, he's out, right?
That's correct. He can't be treated differently than other employees.
Right, but if their across-the-board policy is really, we have a zero-tolerance policy for accidents, that's it.
That's right, Your Honor, and it doesn't have that policy here, and it doesn't have that practice either, as based on all the evidence that was submitted before the ALJ. And I think that really goes to the...
You misunderstood, I think, the significance of your own regulations. These regulations set minimum standards. Now, suppose a judge says, well, look, okay, this driver is not worse than the very minimum. He can still keep his license, but he is a dangerous driver. And I've provided other relief to the plaintiff. And balancing everything, I think, you know, with the relief I've given him, and he is an unsafe driver, although he's not below the minimum qualifications that Department of Transportation imposes, I don't think he should be reinstated. Now, is that within his equitable discretion, or is he bound by the regulations?
It's within his equitable discretion. And I didn't mean to overstate the case, Your Honor, but it's our understanding.
You certainly overstated the case.
Well,
the brief strongly suggested that he'd have to be far worse than he is in order to be denied reinstatement.
Well, I think that point is true.
Well, maybe you were arguing from the other side, though. I mean, because here we have a decision where the board doesn't want to have him fired. And the question, I think, is whether the board abused its discretion in allowing Mr. Cefalu to have reinstatement as opposed to front pay. It's not whether it would also have abused its discretion if it had said, no, only front pay will do in these circumstances. I mean, either one might be within the scope of the board's discretion.
That's a good point, Your Honor. I would agree with that. If I could just make a general point about these kinds of cases, normally the employer is trying to defend or to prevent the reinstatement or to defend itself against the charge of retaliation based on its own policies and its own practices. I mean, this is a rare case where the company is taking outside law and bringing in just a general statement of public policy. And Judge Woods, your comment about that companies may have stricter standards, I think is usually the case, and that's why the companies rely on their own practices as the basis for refusing the reinstatement or defending against the charge in the first place.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sturman. So, Mr. Taylor?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Paul Taylor. I represent Peter Cefalu. I want to pick up where Mr. Sturman left off. I agree that the court would have equitable power to deny reinstatement. The board has, in a series of decisions, said reinstatement is the ordinary remedy, but as this court recognized in the July 25th, 2007 opinion, that there are practical considerations to it. If you lose an arm, lose an eye, you can't do the job, well, obviously then you have to look to something that the court said, Judge Wood said, is a practical equivalent to reinstatement. So I suppose the court could award front pay. I think the problem with the regulations, I agree, Judge Posner, they set a minimum standard. There is a whole series of regulations, though. For example, there's a regulation that says Roadway is required to do a background check when they hire. They were required to contact UPS and find out his work record, his accidents, and that's in 49 CFR Part 391. They were required to contact every DOT-regulated employer under Part 391 that Mr. Cefalu listed on his application. So they were required to talk to UPS. They were required to talk to ANR. So there's other schemes of regulations that say you can't let a driver drive tired. They have to meet a physical. They are obviously minimum standards, and Roadway can have a higher standard. In fact, they did not have a standard, higher standard. If Roadway today wanted to say, we're going to start bumping people with one fender bender, I suppose they could do it. They can change it. They'd probably have to negotiate it with the union, negotiate new work rules. The union would raise the issue, well, this violates a past practice. But, for example, just taking out the union out as an element for a second, they could, in fact, put on a new rule and elevate the standard. You know, this law is intended to advance safety. And, in fact, that would be perhaps something that should be done in the trucking industry. All the people we cited, or many of them, Donna Sexton, Don Payne, people with 13 accidents, people running off the road.
It was a grim account, actually,
yeah,
for
indeed.
Those of us on the road.
In fact, it's a pathetic state of affairs in the trucking industry on that basis. And it's not just in the unionized trucking. I mean, there are studies. In fact, the DOT is revamping its hours of service regulations. It's been in and out of litigation with the D.C. Circuit for years, but it indicates that there's numerous drivers who drive impaired due to fatigue, and the logbook falsification is widespread. But that isn't the issue here. The issue here is, did the board err in failing to, did it abuse its discretion in reinstating Cefalu? And I think not. You know, at this point, what you really have, you have a driver who, prior to he joined Roadway, he dissembled, we will agree on his driving record with ANR and UPS, but prior to leaving Roadway, he had had two serious accidents, one of which his affidavit says was non-preventable, where a car cut him off. The other one, he admits he fell asleep at the wheel. But if you look at Cefalu's driving record in its totality, I think he started driving in 1977, he's had, I believe, five accidents if you count the little fender benders. And even one of them, they didn't put anything in the record except a little computer printout that alleged something. There were two warning letters issued. So he had two fender benders, and he's had two serious accidents in a 30-year driving career. These are big trucks. They're doubles. In the industry, they call them wiggle wagons because they have a crack-the-whip effect. It's four pieces of equipment, two trailers, a dolly, a tractor. They're 80,000 pounds. You're in and out of traffic, and you run 100,000-plus miles a year. You're going to have accidents. For them to say, well, this guy is an unsafe driver, yet they put him on the road.
Are there any statistics about the average number of accidents of driving the various types of trucks? Is that something DOT publishes?
Well, there is a website called safer.org, which is the DOT, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration's website, where you can break down the safety record of each carrier and then look at out-of-service items, which would be if you see a I'm going to call them smokies, you see a trooper on the side of the highway doing a roadside inspection, and they're going through the paperwork, you know, they plug that into data that's transmitted to Washington, D.C., and if they give an out-of-service order to a driver, you can find minor violations, or you might find out-of-service violations, and you can get that detail online. The national average for drivers being placed out of service, which would be include drug tests, the paperwork out of order, logbooks, is about 6.6%, and Roadway falls right in about that average. For a driver out of service, for equipment out of service, and this is an appalling figure, about 22% of every vehicle checked in a roadside inspection, and this is all on this website, 22% of the vehicles checked in roadside inspections are put out of service because they are so unsafe they shouldn't proceed further. So it's a sad commentary on the industry. But that aside, we're dealing here whether or not they made the showing, whether or not Cefalu is so unsafe he shouldn't drive. He's got arms, legs, he's got a CDL, and in fact, in fact, has received safety awards from Roadway since his return.
Why do you have any idea why the company is so coy about the informant?
I have suspicions.
In general, I mean, this is a practice that...
No, it's not a practice.
To anyone who complains about a driver.
They offered some pages from the deposition of Philip Stanek, the vice president of labor for Roadway. He said that he knew, and these pages are in tab 11 of their appendix, he said that he knew in December or January, a full, you know, approximately 2 months before they even fired Cephalo, that he had falsified his employment application, which I think militates against that argument. And the entire deposition wasn't in there, but he had indicated he was talking with, well, how did you find out? When I asked him at his deposition, how did you find out? He said, well, we were talking to union officials all over the country and need to have safe drivers. And I said, so it was a union official? And he said, oh, I didn't say that. So, you know, there's politics within the union, and, I mean, I have hunches as to who disclosed this. But we don't know because they won't tell us, and it's not coyness, Your Honor. It's defiance. They said, Judge Leland, we're not going to obey your order, and that's not the way you can have due process in this country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Mr. Posey, so you have 2 minutes left.
To address a couple of the numerous points that have been raised, with regard to the individual in question and when we learned of this, I understand we're not going to argue over whether or not that's on the table, so to speak, but just to clarify the record, what is in the supplemental information that we provided indicates that approximately 1 month before Mr. Cephalo was terminated, the company learned this information, and upon receiving documentation that verified it, he was immediately terminated upon receiving the documentation. In other words, the company learned the information, investigated to make sure it was accurate and really happened, and as soon as they learned it did, he was terminated. In any event, with regard to some of these administrative regulation arguments, one of the points raised about the trucking industry regulations that was, I think, glossed over a little bit is that there's a very distinct difference in a number of these regulations as to what their purpose is and what impact that has on from a public policy perspective. Now, for example, in that Eastern Coal case that Department of Labor's counsel mentioned, that was a case where the particular regulation that was violated was one implementing a statute that regards drug testing and substance abuse testing for drivers. It was found that in that case, because one of the primary statutory aims was the rehabilitation of these drug or alcohol-using drivers, that their reinstatement was appropriate as a remedy. Here, there's certainly, I would hope, no argument that...
That makes us feel really comfortable also. Reinstating the drug addict as part of his rehabilitation.
We would share your discomfort with that, and frankly, I would point out that certainly there's no argument, I hope, that the Surface Transportation Assistance Act is in part designed to rehabilitate dangerous drivers by bringing them back to work for further sessions. The only other point I would ask to make is with regard to Mr. Cephalo's particular driving record, we understand that there are other drivers at Roadway who do not have clean driving records and that there are some of them who have had accidents. But we would not, as was posed in the Department of Labor's brief, consider pointing out those dangerous tendencies to be fear-mongering to the court. There's been issues raised that he, for example, received safety awards. I believe Mr. Cephalo's brief notes that at UPS, he received an award as a safe driver and was subsequently terminated for crashing his truck on an interstate highway. So, again, I come back to the point that the issue here is not how much time can he go without an accident. We shouldn't have to cross our fingers and hope that the next one isn't going to be more serious than the last. And on that grounds alone, feel that we should be justified in not bringing him back to work and having to keep him behind the wheel, whatever either this court or the administrative agency decides is a more appropriate remedy.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Posey and Mr. Sturman and Mr. Taylor.